Hello, it's Rob Raccoon.
And this is Jeff.
All right.
Okay, I think it's just us so far.
Oh, it's Cheryl Jernigan.
Hi, Cheryl.
How are you?
Good.
And this is Jeff. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Jeff.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a very hot day today.
Is it?
86.
Wow. You're right. Big change.
That's my weather report.
Good. Good. Well, we'll just wait a minute or so and let other people join us. And Cheryl, do you have any questions that you'd like to pose for the discussion?
Well, you know, I remember you telling me a long time ago that not to watch the news, but, you know, I can't help it. I'm a news junkie. So, you know, all these layoffs and closings and everything is supposedly turning around, but I think it's, I'm more interested, I think, today in what you have to say.
Okay.
And what, how you feel like the climate of everything is going, and you always have such insight on these matters.
Well, we'll do our best here. I heard a couple of other people join. There's no need to announce yourselves if you don't want. If there are any questions, I don't know if anyone's near their computer, you can email me, or if you want to pose a question now before we begin, if anyone want to do that, who's on the phone.
Hi, Robert. Rob, this is George.
Hi, George.
I wanted to ask about some comments about currency diversification at this time.
Okay. Good. 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 Anyone else on the phone who'd like to pose a question? Okay, well, why don't we start with a general overview of the economy, and then we'll move on to the individual questions. So overall, the issue in the news is whether we have turned the corner, whether we're actually in a V-shaped recovery, or whether this is just kind of a false bottom, which is something that historically would be more expected, that you would see in the news signs of a recovery. There's so much hope for a recovery in real estate prices. Hi, Joe.
Bob.
And so looking overall at the economy and then the markets, you know, are we really over the worst of it? Is the worst behind us? My sense is that it looks that way, and we can hope that it is, but I don't believe that we have turned the corner either as an economy or as the market, even though we're in a strong rally. And you know, the news is less bad, let's say that the rate of decline certainly has diminished, and that's a good thing. And the incredibly large financial stimulus that's both being done on the part of the U.S. government and overseas governments has really yet to hit. There's an optimism that the money will be out there and that things are looking better. But I think it's important to look really at the details and see what kind of spending is going on to see whether it really makes sense and that it will generate growth in the economy, both the foreign economies and our own, as opposed to, let's say, just transfer payments from the government to individuals who are in trouble with their mortgages or commercial loans or what have you. So let's talk first about employment, because it's not that I don't think watching the news and listening is important, but really believing that what you hear in the news is giving you the full picture is what I think it's important to keep in mind as you listen to the various pundits and read the news. Certainly the statistics that are reported about factory utilization or employment or consumer confidence, real estate sales, what have you, all of those numbers are, I won't call them quite shots in the dark, but they're really guesses. And the data that's used to make sort of regular pronouncements is so rough that to draw any conclusions, I think, is wrong, either optimistic or pessimistic conclusions. So my sense of the overall economy is that unemployment will continue to get worse over time here, and that we will see unemployment over we'll see unemployment over 10 or 11%, maybe even 12%, and right now we're at about 8 to 9%, and so there are a lot of reasons why that's happening. Kind of the crescendo of retail sales, so the stock market has taken, and I think the same thing is true about real estate. You've seen sort of a turnaround in some areas. I wouldn't call it a turnaround, but you've seen a bottom perhaps be reached in the prices of some homes, some communities in California and maybe even Arizona. Let's see. Could you put your phone on mute, Cheryl? I think that's, I don't know if those are your dogs.
Well, how did you know that?
Well, I just recognized their tone of voice.
Very good.
Thanks. The economy has not pulled out of its decline. Banks have not substantially reintroduced credit into the system. In order to borrow money, in order for small businesses to borrow money, there are very high barriers to doing that. And you saw today the news about the Congress passing the credit card sort of consumer bill of rights. And the banks are kind of crying about how they're going to make up their losses on the increasing amounts of consumer debt that's going bad, and they have a point. The delinquencies and defaults on credit cards is above 10% and likely to going to get worse. The banks have essentially been given a license to make money by the government by being able to borrow almost at no cost, and then to turn around and I'm not sure what they're doing with their money other than refinancing homes. So the worst, I think, is not yet out. The whole market for commercial mortgages, commercial real estate, has not really been put on the table. Insurance company issues I think, are also yet to surface, and that's probably going to be a follow-on to the commercial real estate market.
Rob, this is Joe Jernigan. When do you think the we're just starting to see the commercial real estate piece bubble up in our markets here?
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so the question is, when will the commercial real estate market troubles come to the surface? Is that the question?
Yes.
If they're
not already here, they're just kind of where it seems to be on the front end of a commercial real estate collapse.
That's correct. That's right. The you know, everyone knows the downside of what's happened in the residential real estate market, and so I think this is kind of the tenor of what's going on in the news, and it's why I just caution people about listening and really believing what they see in the media, is that there are so many things at risk for a crescendo of declining commercial real estate market. The banks, the insurance companies, ultimately the government, have such a vested interest in seeing that not happen, or at least not create another sense of panic on the part of individuals, you know, because of the pessimism that it generates, that they'll likely do something behind closed doors to allow the banks and insurance companies to not account for the decline in real estate values, and the government will likely step in and back the commercial mortgage securities as they have the residential mortgage securities, even though the commercial ones are essentially private. They're inured to the benefit of private investors, and I don't think that we'll see it in the news. I think that they'll try and wrap up those problems like they have the banks' problems, in the sense of the stress tests that everyone has read about that were in the news maybe a week or two ago, saying, okay, well, basically all the banks are okay. Some of them need to raise capital. Maybe Bank of America is not. It had the biggest sort of red check mark or X mark, whatever. But essentially, all of this is being orchestrated so as to not scare the public. And I think if you're out there to sell commercial real estate, you're in a deep hole at the moment. And then if you have to refinance, which is the case with many people who developed commercial real estate, especially light commercial and strip malls, those people are quietly going to be sort of tucked away in the corner, and the only evidence that we'll see of it will be lots and lots of vacancies. The idea being that traditionally what has brought an economy out of recession, a deep recession, has been consumer spending. And it's estimated that consumer spending is going to go down permanently, and this is what I believe, about 10% from where it was, let's say, 18 months ago, that it will not return up to the levels seen in the mid-2000s, and that country's growth rate, which people, you know, like to peg between 2-4% as a healthy growth rate, and we'll talk more about growth rates and debt and the debt that's being taken on in order to sort of paper over, I guess that's the right word, paper over these problems that we've seen the last 12 months. Those are the two main factors, are the debt and then what the impact is on growth. And so one piece of the equation is you take an engine of growth being consumers and you shrink it by 10% permanently. Because the main theme that we're seeing is a deleveraging or a reduction of consumer spending and an increase in consumers and individuals trying to get their personal finances in some kind of a less debt-oriented, lower mortgages, lower credit card payments. And I think that that's certainly among people who are, let's say, over 50, who are looking at what are they going to do about retirement, that that's the common theme, and that's really a big change from the last, 30 years or so. So the markets, to move on to the impact of these factors on the markets have seen about a 30% increase from the lows in March, and that's good. Whether it's sustainable, whether the rally is here for good, I doubt it, and there are many companies that have not participated in the rally, primarily energy companies, real estate companies, some basic material, raw material commodities have started back up, and we'll talk more about that when we talk about inflation and diversification. So I believe that it's very likely that the market at some point will retest the lows that we saw in March, probably more than once. And so I think that the overview is that this is not kind of a short and sharp recession that we're on our way out of, that we're likely to dip back down again and then take a very long time to climb back out, and it will look substantially different than the recoveries that we're all used to, being that they're U.S. driven, that they're sensitive to the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, that's what ignites economic recoveries, and that our markets really sort of pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. I don't think that that's going to happen. And so I think the global investment environment has changed dramatically, and so I think that's the overview here. Let me see if there's anyone who's joined us who has any questions, and then I'll put them down on the list here. I have several to go back over, but is there anyone who has a burning question that they want me to address sometime here?
If this is Joe. I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is Robert in Colorado.
Okay.
Could you make some more comments about the anticipated growth rate, economic growth rate, U.S. when we come out of this, or as we come out of it? You said 2 to 4 usually. What's it going to do?
Okay.
And that's it.
Good. Okay. And Joe?
Yeah, I guess on a personal note, if I were sitting on a fairly heavily invested equity position, and it were your money and not mine, would you be looking to move that into some fixed incomes and or cash? Or
okay,
I've been reluctant to do that because on the basis of I've never tried to time the market, and it seems
sure.
Like every time I've tried, I've been burned. So
yeah,
I've been holding
good
on
question.
For the kickback, and
that's good.
It's not going to be a kickback. It's going to be kind of a continuing roller coaster. So
well, we've had somewhat of a rebound already,
right,
in the market from its lows. The question is how high does it go, and is it really the start of a new bull market or not? And I think the answer is no to that. Hopefully, I'm wrong, but so the question becomes, what percent is the right amount to move to fixed income and when? And so I'll come back to the whole fixed income question because we do a lot of work in that area. Let's just stay for a little bit on the macro scale and talk a little bit more about sort of the future. There's, I think, three scenarios that are possible. And portfolio strategy, which is what we're all about and what I spend most of my time thinking about, and which is why I assume most of you tune in to these calls other than to hear my very small insights about the world, is that, number one, that the plan of spending our way back into a traditional growth mode works, and that the transfer of debt, which is what we've seen for the last year, is a huge debt on the part of businesses and consumers being assumed by the government at a cost of, and I'll put these numbers into context for a change. The cost that's been recognized on the books so far is about let's say $2 trillion, somewhere between $1 and $3 trillion. The actual cost of spending to take care of all of the problems, the excesses of the past, let's say 20 years, I believe is somewhere closer to $12 trillion. So I think we're about a third to a quarter of the way into recognizing, at least on, you know, having out in the open, the true cost of taking the leverage, the debt that was taken on, and putting aside who took on the debt, who, you know, the reasons for it, what, you know, whose fault it was, et cetera, putting all that aside, that's probably a conservative estimate of the cost. Now, you remember when we have, the government has committed, let's say, about $7 trillion, you know, in words, but in deeds they've spent about $2 trillion on bailing out the residential mortgage market and freeing up the commercial market short term and supporting countries that would otherwise have gone bankrupt, like Iceland and the IMF and all of the things. We're talking about on a macro scale. And so the U.S. government has committed around $7 verbally. I believe it will cost more than that. If there is not growth in the world and we end up just kind of mired in a very slow, moribund kind of world economy for the next few years, the cost of servicing all of the debt that's been issued will balloon the cost of the overall bailout to where it equals about the world's output is about $15 trillion a year. Now that we're talking in trillions, we can sort of talk about how much value does the world produce a year, and what's the cost of bailing out the various entities that are in trouble to get things back on an even keel. So we're not quite even with the world's output, and it's not like this situation hasn't ever been seen before. At the end of World War II, the debt was about the same as the world's output. That is, the debt for carrying on World War II was about the same as the world's output in 1945. And, you know, the world had a reconstruction period, and it drove a lot of economies upwards. And so it's not that this one-time event is necessarily a sinker, you know, the end of the game, by any means. And it brings back to the discussion is what are the policies and what are the signs that we're going to make this a one-time event and have it succeed. That's the first scenario, that it succeeds, that the world's economies start to generate, that exports from Asia start up again to the U.S. or to Europe, or which is really the most feasible way, the traditional way that we've bailed out the world before, is by Europe and the U.S. consuming, because Asia, and including China, only represents about 10% of the world's economy. And even if China grows by 5 to 10%, it's such a small part of the world's economy that it's not going to generate enough demand to end a recession, a deep recession in Europe and the U.S. And so all of the politics of Europe and America become very important, and that's when we get to the discussion about growth rates and debt and how are those two issues managed. So let's talk about the debt first, and I'm sorry to run out on so long. I guess this is still part of the overview. But it impacts portfolio strategy to a very great extent, because if Europe and the U.S. Bail out the banks financially with paper, but the banks don't create credit for entrepreneurial activities, then you have a non-productive use of debt. And the growth of the economy will not be reignited.
Couldn't they make that conditional on that?
Well, you know, they can't force the bankers to lend. What if you look, the one area that they've done is they've basically said, and I said this last time when we had our last call in, was that if you waited and wanted to refinance your house and had good credit, the government was going to tell the banks to refinance people's mortgages around 4 to 5%. Now, in order to do that, they're paying the banks and the mortgage companies $1,000 or $2,000 for each mortgage that they rewrite, and then they're also charging the consumer a couple of thousand dollars to refinance, and essentially it's a no-risk business for the bank. So they can't force the banks to lend, but they can make it so profitable that they'll just do it, which is what's happening with single-family refinancings. But for any kind of business loan, unless the government goes in and dictates that you will lend, it doesn't have to happen. You can see they've already kind of retracted on the executive compensation caps for banks that they were talking about. The short answer is no, they can't make the banks unless they exert their managerial control, which would be a very difficult thing to do politically. It would be admitting that we have nationalized the banks, and we're very far away from that. The productive use of loans would be another productive use of the debt would be infrastructure. Now, during the campaign, there was a lot of talk about rebuilding America's infrastructure, the electric grid, the computer access, highways, byways, and as far as I can tell, that's not a major focus or public transportation, that's not been a major focus of any of the bills in front of Congress for spending, that's something that would fuel future growth, and it's when you see in China where they're spending their stimulus package, it's basically on infrastructure, and it's not going to bail people out of their mortgages. It's not going to bail out the banking system. It's oriented towards infrastructure. So The issue of whether, and that's where the money went to, of course, in the Marshall Plan and in World War II, is it went to build factories and highways and, you know, and all of that stuff through the 50s. So that's something to look for, and that if it doesn't, if a lot of the investment of the debt that's issued doesn't end up in infrastructure, then it's likely then that that debt will not generate future growth, the growth that's needed to pay off the debt. Everyone understands the mathematics of debt, that the longer you carry it and you sort of build up larger and larger amounts of debt, the harder it is to ever get out from under it. And so that's what we'll be looking at. The other two scenarios, besides if it does reignite the traditional growth, is number one, that there that it doesn't ignite growth, and that we have a period of just kind of very low growth worldwide, and everyone assumes that inflation is coming back because there's so much debt that's been taken on, but that's not necessarily true. You can have a period where demand is just not, people have don't have confidence in the future. They don't reinvest in new companies, in hiring new employees, in taking risks, and they just hunker down. That's what you saw in Japan. That's what you saw and you see now in Japan, is an economy where they've lowered interest rates to zero, but no one is doing anything, and they haven't done anything for 20 years. They just have failed to fess up to their problems, and people have hunkered down, and so you have actually a long period of deflation with no growth, and the only investment strategy that works in an environment like that is buying high quality bonds when you don't have global growth. The third possibility is that you have a period where growth goes to new parts of the world as opposed to Europe and America, where domestic demand is allowed to be stimulated in Asia or other parts of the world, and you have I don't want to use the word flatter world because that was used by someone else in a book, but where you have a much greater distribution of economic activity. And entrepreneurship, and in which case the debt does generate growth, but the growth is in non-traditional areas, and then you get the possibility of real inflation, where people are competing for oil, steel, concrete, like they were 3 years ago or so, but this time, you know, China and the U.S. don't have a sort of a lockdown on the natural resources of the world, and it's just kind of a free-for-all, and then the debt that, let's say Europe issues debt in order to save Eastern Europe and Iceland and those places, and the growth is not there, then their costs go up dramatically. I use Europe as an example because they have a higher kind of rigid social structure to deal with in terms of change, and so it's likely to be seen in Europe earlier than in the U.S. where you have severe inflationary pressures. And that's another way that this whole crisis could be played out, and then the investment strategy becomes very different from investing in high quality bonds. Because when inflation comes back in that scenario, you have interest rates going up sharply, and then your bonds lose money, and you have to do other kinds of investing. Overseas in commodities, in things that will rise with that global economy that's not U.S. Centric. And that's I'm not sure if I answered anyone's question or not, but it does bring me on to the issue of currencies. I think it did address the issue about growth, the growth of the world's economies versus the U.S. and the amount of debt are very interrelated. If you get global growth of 4%, then the debt is manageable. If you have global growth of 0 to 2%, it's not. And if you have inflation due to competition for resources, which I think is coming, then some people will be able to pay their debt off and other nations will not. And I think that's a very likely scenario where you'll have government defaults in certain parts of the world because they have not reinvested wisely the money that they've gotten by taking on the debt. So let me turn briefly to the issue of currency diversification, and there's certainly a case to be made that Brazil and China are now talking about doing as an early example of conducting their trade not in dollars but in the Chinese currency or in the British. In the Brazilian currency, which I think is very far-fetched. China is a I don't know what to call it, an autocracy, whatever. It's anything but a free market, and there is no chance that China will become a currency that the world uses, because the government there is ruthless in its pursuit of its national agenda. In a, you know, I guess every country probably is, but as the Chinese become more sophisticated and show more sort of, in quotes, interest in other countries, you know, quality of life, they might have a little bit of a chance. But the issue of what is an alternative to the U.S. dollar as a currency is a question that is not that relevant to most investors, certainly most U.S. investors, because there's very few ways of diversifying. But even if it was easier to do so, if you look at Europe and Japan as the other two major currencies, neither one of them has a real leg up on the U.S. in terms of addressing their long-term economic issues. And so I don't believe that the U.S. dollar, even though for all of the lack of financial discipline and all of the cover-ups, the U.S. dollar will remain, I think, the world's reserve currency until such time as the global growth is recognized to be sort of decentralized and outside of the U.S. And what's likely to happen in terms of currencies is that the Middle Eastern countries and the Chinese and anyone who has something of value to trade who's not happy with the U.S. Will look to create some kind of a basket of natural resources on which trade can occur. So the closest analogy I can give is in the olden times, people used gold as a basis of currency. You could only have as much money as was backed by gold. That is, I think, highly unlikely to happen for gold to come back. But if you take gold and other metals and you add in strategic energy reserves, oil reserves, natural gas reserves, even agricultural resources, that you'll be able to create a basket of real commodities on which the value of trade can be fixed. And it's not really something that individuals or individual investors will participate in, but as places like China and Asia and certain Latin American countries, you know, want to diversify outside of the U.S. dollars, I think that's the direction that it will go. That's about it for that issue. I had a couple of people email me some questions about the debt that we're taking on as a country and the effect that that might have on people who live on a fixed income, particularly who live on Social Security or who rely on Medicare. And what is the likely scenario for those, you know, for people who rely on those sorts of funds? And I guess maybe you saw the projections from the government itself about the I guess the hospital fund of Medicare is slated to run out of money in about 8 years, and that the Social Security fund is about 20 years after that, slated to run out of money. And so unless there's another period of strong economic growth, those numbers look very daunting, and the conclusions that one can draw, I think, are really quite simple, and everyone probably draws them for themselves, is that that the benefits won't exist, that however loath we are to admit that the cost of medical care in the U.S., which is a whole nother ball of wax, but I think everyone should be aware that about 30% of our medical budget goes to treating people in the last year of their life, and the cost of the extraordinary measures that people take to live a few months longer sucks up about a third of our nation's expenditures on healthcare, which I can't remember what percent of our gross product that is, but does anyone know that number offhand? I think it's around 17% of the gross. It's certainly about 50% higher than most other nations in the world. And at the current rate of growth, it's slated to double in the next 10 years. And so the growth of medical costs, which the president talks about, is certainly untenable. And I think Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits for people who make over a certain amount will just go away, and it will become just a pure safety net like Medicaid is now, where you have to be under a certain amount of wealth and income to qualify for Medicaid, and Medicare is in my mind headed in that direction, and similarly Social Security, that's used to provide a basic income for people that are in some kind of straits, that's what Social Security will become, and you know, people who have investment income or earned income will simply not get benefits. That's clearly the way that the future looks. I think, you know, no matter what, and so I'm not quite sure when or who will fess up to that fact. Certainly no one has a political interest in facing those issues until they actually happen. It's probably a little like the budget in California. Until they're on their last gasp, no one's really willing to acknowledge and adapt to the new circumstances. So, I wish I was a little bit more upbeat.
Hard to be.
Let's see. Is there anyone who's on the line who has some other topics that they'd like to see covered? We have another 15 minutes or so, so I'd like to make sure I cover what's on people's minds.
You mentioned three scenarios before, but a fourth one, which kind of readily comes to mind, you didn't mention, which is a kind of catastrophic collapse.
Okay. The activity that we saw last fall where Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and there was basically a freeze in the banking environment where banks would not lend money to each other was averted basically because people have, I think, a number of tools to deal with institutional crises. We have the World Bank, the IMF. We have coordination between central banks, and so I think it's highly unlikely that there'll be a catastrophe because there is in the world enough capital to let's say wipe out all of the transgressions that we're currently dealing with. I have a chart that shows who has the money, who's got the goods in the world, and basically, remember I said the size of the problem that we're dealing with, it's cost $3 trillion. The government has pledged $7 trillion. I think it's going to cost between $10 and $15 trillion. The world's output is around $15 trillion a year. The insurance companies by themselves at the end of 2007 had $18 trillion in their coffers. Mutual funds have $26 trillion, pension funds $28 trillion. Individuals around the world have $37 trillion. It's probably down now with the loss of the last year and a half to about $30 trillion. And the big players that you would think, that is, let's say, China and the Middle Eastern countries, just to give you a sense of comparison, they have, in terms of excess capital, in what we call sovereign wealth funds, about $3 trillion. And so the capital exists to right the system. It's locked up in various places that have a vested interest in serving, their owners, insurance companies or pension funds. But I don't believe that that the system will go down, because whatever the size of the problems are, there is enough capital to fix it. Okay. It may require a readjustment, as I think what you're seeing in the auto industry, and we should see in the banking industry if the wisdom is there to actually restructure it, which I'm not really convinced that there is. But the people lose money. People lose their pensions. Consumer choices go down. Bondholders get the rules changed on them, and the government steps in and lays down the rules and changes the rules to meet what it perceives to be the most highest or common public good. Whether we agree with their estimation of what that is or not is not relevant, but the government can come in and appropriate money from the insurance companies. It has, in fact, I saw something today, where they're talking now about taxing insurance benefits. You know, traditionally, life insurance is not taxed. And that's just because of the insurance lobby. If they change that law, which would be kind of the first crack in the insurance lobby, they'll generate, whatever, a couple of billion dollars, $10, $20 billion. But the power of the central governments to appropriate funds to address these issues is very real, because the insurance companies and the pension funds rely on the government for their functioning, just like the banks did. And the bankers lobby and the political, it's too early in the political game, really, for anyone to say what they think, how big the banks' problems are, how the bankers, you know, should be basically paid like government bureaucrats. That time has not yet come. I think it will come. It may be 5 to 10 years out when we know what scenario is being followed. But the disaster scenario, I don't think is likely at all, because of the power of the central governments. So that's my view about the things melting down. It doesn't mean at the same time, from an investment perspective, that when the government gets involved, it doesn't mean that returns on stocks, goes back to what it was for the last three decades. I think it means anything but that. So what does one do investment-wise to deal with an environment where the government has a much larger role, for better or worse, I think, in many ways, from the point of view of generating true growth, real growth that will solve the issues, that is, in terms of promoting entrepreneurial activity, reinvesting in infrastructure and things like that. The government may not make the right decisions, but it still has the power to reduce the returns to individuals so that there's a measure of social order. And I think that's what it will do. So looking for high returns is a very difficult task in an environment like this, and it becomes very challenging in terms of owning stocks, that you need to know the companies well, and be willing to sell and take profits without worrying about taxes, which are, of course, likely to go up dramatically. They're talking now about reinstating what they were before George W., and they'll likely go up from there in New York City. I'm not sure if there's anyone from New York City on the phone. But the tax rate on New York City residents will be above 60% next year. And it doesn't really, it's certainly been higher than that in the past for everyone. The tax rates used to be 70%. On high earning individuals, and I think they could well go back there. So keeping money after taxes is I think the challenge, and tax free bonds is no longer a no brainer activity. There are issuers that are in trouble. It doesn't mean that there aren't some risks worth taking, because I think there are. I think that's a really excellent area. If we have one, either the no growth scenario, or a long recovery back to traditional growth, tax-free bonds make a lot of sense. For people, certainly on the 1, 2, 3 year scale, where you can take home, 3-4%, certainly on a taxable equivalent basis, that's not great, but it's not bad either. So, and there, with all of the new government spending, there are a tremendous number of new types of bonds coming out. There are states now that are issuing taxable bonds that are partially backed by the government in order to fund this, you know, this Rebuild America program. I'm not quite sure what Rebuild America means, but it's there. So that's my long answer to your short question, George.
Okay, thank you. Very helpful.
Good. Let's see. I keep asking for questions. Any burning questions? Simmering questions? I need to solicit my daughter to join us on the phone call. She's usually full of questions. Let me talk for a minute about inflation in a little bit more detail, and then ask that, you know, how to protect if inflation does happen, what one can do to protect oneself against it. And, you know, in many ways, inflation would be a good thing because it would mean that the world's economies, at least some of them, have recovered. And my sense is that we'll see the U.S. And Asia recover before Japan and Europe, and primarily because of the political environment being promoting entrepreneurship more here and in Asia than in Europe and in Japan. And so we talked earlier about the debt, and certainly the traditional way of people paying debt off would be for governments to print money and inflate their way out of debt. And that you could make a strong case that we've printed the first $3 trillion, right, for the bailout. And if it costs $12 trillion, we'll print the other $9 trillion. It only works as long as the governments step up, or the pension funds, or mutual funds, or insurance companies buy the debt, which the government can mandate that they do. So that Social Security, that the insurance companies, they can't mandate that private individuals buy government debt, but certainly the pension funds, which control $28 trillion, rely on the government's functioning as do insurance companies, and so they can spread the debt out to those folks in return for continued support of those industries and those companies. And I think that's very likely what will happen. So it's not like we rely on the Chinese to buy our debt, even though they have been buying it. They're not the only option for funding the deficit. If growth comes back in a storm from Asia, or we do, you know, we do catch on, and there's a sort of a surging demand here, then inflation will come back. And inflation traditionally has been very good for stocks, especially for natural resource stocks. And in fact, the people would say, well, that's one of the answers to the real estate market, is to have inflation. That traditionally was what bailed out people, and I'm not a believer that will bail out the real estate industry, as it has in the past, because you can have inflation for certain kinds of goods like raw materials, but not, let's say, for housing or wages. If there's an oversupply of housing or an oversupply of educated people, and there's not enough jobs or enough buyers, I guess those, and those two are related, then it's not a sure thing that inflation will bail out people who are underwater with the with their houses or their real estate investments. To fill up retail and commercial space, you need new businesses. To fill up housing, you either need prices to go down to the point where they will be filled up, which I think you've seen in Arizona and some parts of California, where prices declined by 50%, and now there are people sort of clamoring, both investors and people who still have jobs, to get back in. So I think, you know, if you have a steady source of income, whether it's investment income or wage income, earned income, you're in the best position to take advantage of a continued deflation in housing prices. And we will all sort of suffer with inflation of other prices, medical care, education, you know, decent food, things like that, I think will continue to go up. The inflation on raw materials, on industrial materials, is something that very forward-looking companies and countries are trying to get their arms around now, while prices are fairly low. So you're starting to see activity in terms of the purchase of mining companies, natural resource rights in various places around the world by forward-looking strategic planners, particularly the Chinese, who are buying up real assets around the world in anticipation of, you know, the demand that 7 billion people on the planet, of which only 1 to 2 billion are, you know, in the middle class as of yet. So as you have India and China sort of roll out a great number of educated young people who all are aware of, you know, what's out there in terms of material goods, you're likely to see that kind of demand, and I think that's you know, in the works. So when looking at companies, that's what we look at, is who is in a position to participate in that growth, because those are some of the big numbers of consumers that are coming online here. It's interesting that with a sort of a stock market recovery, there's a lot less anxiety in general. I don't know if anyone is feeling anxious or feeling better out there about the world just because the stock market has gone up and you know, the media has the spin that real estate prices have bottomed. And the things that I think are important to look at, and not necessarily the month-to-month announcements, but just the employment levels, I think are the key to when you'll know if the housing market has bottomed or if the economy has recovered. Because as long as the unemployment number, the trend of the unemployment numbers is down, the economy and the markets have, you know, not a very firm base, I think, to stand on. So, any final questions or topics that I have not covered that you would like to see covered, or have I put everyone to sleep?
No.
I hear Jeff snoring in the other room.
Poor Jeff.
Yeah. Well. Any final topics or something that we haven't touched upon?
No, that's good.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and if you're a glutton for punishment, you can come back again at 6 o'clock New Mexico time. And anyway, just if you have any feedback about the call, just please email me. I'd love to hear if you'd like to hear more or less about any particular subject. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll send notice for the next one as well. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
Good. Bye-bye.